Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Sean Penn, whose new novel, his first, is Bob Honey, Who Just Do Stuff. Sean Penn is a five-time Academy Award nominee and a two-time winner for his roles in Clint Eastwood's Mystic River and Gus Van Sant's Milk. But today, he's taking on a new role as novelist with his first book, Bob Honey, Who Just Do Stuff. We're speaking with Sean Penn in New Orleans, where he's filming the Hulu production, The First. Sean Penn, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're no stranger to writing. You grew up with a father who was a writer and a blacklisted one at that. So you know writing is something with high stakes and you take it seriously. And you've done journalism, you've written up interviews and op-ed pieces. So what was it that made you turn to fiction, to this particular form?
Well, I think that starts with what turned me away from writing fiction early on, with the exception of when I moved into writing screenplays, because I think that I was maybe too aware, rightly or wrongly, of, you know, a word we often hear today and that I refer to in the book, optics, that the optics of an actor writing a book, I felt that it was kind of an automatic diminishment that was going to be attached to it. And so I was sort of held back and found other ways to do it. My first writing was in poetry. And I had gone ahead and published in European journals, poetry journals and things like that, but I kind of kept it out of the States, where I just felt there was a squinted eye at that sort of stuff. And then in the back of my head was always a novel about America. I'd started driving at 16 and right away started driving to, you know, cross country and zigzagging to the towns I heard about in songs. And that was the map rather than the straight road. So, you know, it could have been Winslow, Arizona, or New Orleans, Louisiana. And anytime you drive America, you're collecting a lot of stories. And there's a lot of stories attached to the travel across this particular continent that we're all familiar with in literature and in raconteurism and in music. So it was a kind of quietly being written in my head and then always updating itself. Finally, once everything that seemed legitimate was delegitimized in the popular culture to me, then I felt it was just as illegitimate to consider that something would be diminished or not, that it was as valuable as anything else for me to be doing it that way, to be expressing myself that way rather than, say, in a film or a screenplay or acting in something. So I finally said, well, the hell with it, and I didn't want to work with chefs in the kitchen anymore. Because too many of the chefs, actors I'd worked with recently, producers, they were all so interested in selling a movie, and so few were interested in making one. And so I thought, well, with no financial pressure on me and total freedom, I could just write. And then if somebody decided to publish it, well, they were looking at a finished piece, and they were investing of their own volition, where in film, you kind of allude to what you're going to do and set up expectations that may be fulfilled for you but disappointing to those who finance it. And that's a pressure I was no longer interested in.
And so much of theater work and film work is collaborative. So did you like that sense of it just being you and the work?
Yeah, I loved the sense of collaboration too. In fact, if there was anything I loved most in working in film, it was collaboration. But the collaborators changed. And the mission of the collaborators changed. And the self-censorship within the creation of things had become kind of pervasive sickness that I just wanted to run away from. And so I was taking a lot of hot showers every night and then cold again after them to just feel like I could start a new day without being inured to it all. So then in this situation, the collaboration was different. I'm somebody who, as it turns out, when I write a book, I get through a certain amount of it. I'm going to torture my neighbor by saying, come over, because I need to hear it aloud.
Right.
I had a lot of patient neighbors hearing the writing about neighbors.
And, which is great, by the way.
Yeah. And so there was a collaboration by de facto, sort of like it was collaborative simply to have another energy in a room to bounce it off of sometimes. And then also there became that period of time where once I had something finished and I really felt I owned my own sense of the story that I was writing, then I was in a new world editorially, because it wasn't a world that was getting notes from people who'd only gone to business school, which is what you get these days in the movies. And whether or not you've got a kind of decisive final cut contract or something, there's pressures and politics that you're appeasing to keep everyone on board and the energy of putting a film out. And that I'd come to know only how to fail. And so with this, there was such a different attitude from an editor, which was really, now I know what your book is. Let me help you get it clear. I don't understand this section. I'd get a note. I don't understand this section. And then I'd be free to see it with a clear eye and say, oh, I know why they don't understand it. Maybe I need to work this a little bit more, and so on and so forth. That was really a lot of fun.
So tell us about Bob Honey. What does he mean to you? What was it like to make up a fictional character for a book instead of a fictional character for a movie? And what was it like to live with him during the writing of this book?
Well, I'm going to say that Bob Honey is the evolution of the character that I've been writing in my head through all of my travels in life. Had I written my first novel when I first put paper in a typewriter 35 years ago to do that, and never got past page 1.5, it was, in essence, the beginning of this book. Much different, I suppose, than where it would have gone. We were in a very different America, a different world.
There were typewriters. I mean, that's a difference.
Yeah. That is a big difference. That's a big difference to Bob. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a kind of, I think that in the feeling of freedom in writing, I think that I immediately acknowledge the things that I would have hoped to acknowledge and not been stuck with, say, a set idea. But it was never, even in the beginning when I first thought of writing a book, which is about 35 years ago, it was always going to be melody-based. But to hold in my bandwidth a book of about 160 pages and have to go back and look at it for conventional storytelling or conventional storytelling clarity was never going to be in my skill set. So it was really about the way that I saw the world, the way that I experienced the world was much more melody than lyrics anyway. And so I was able to stay with my own story by having a sense of which way the melody was going.
Well, it's rare indeed you can find a character whose worldview encompasses the anarchist cookbook and the origins of consciousness and the breakdown of bicameral mind. You know, that's a pretty big range there, I think. Now, you know, when critics look at books and they try to describe them, they draw comparisons to other writers. And this is a book that, you know, if I were looking at it, I would see Jack Kerouac. Of course, it's a road novel. Tom Robbins, because so much of it is really funny. Christopher Buckley for such satire. And Barry Gifford for the wild adventure of it all. But really, finally, it combines into something new. It's your voice. And was this something you had to search for? Did it come easily to you? Did you dive into it when you began to write? Was there a mindset? Or was it that musical stuff that was working in you?
I think the thing that first turned me on about acting, that my dad, who had been a writer and a director and an actor, was directing an episode of a TV show called Kojak when I was in high school and long before I considered being an actor. And he was having trouble casting they were doing, as they do today in a lot of television shows, pulling stories from the headlines. And there were some New York headlines about mob hits being done by juveniles, because they could, you know, juveniles would be, if they were they caught, they'd be tried as a juvenile. So he was looking to cast this young hitman, and he had, on a whim, he said, do you want to try this? You want to come in and read for us? And so I spent all night, you know, learning this part, learning the words on this thing, and paying great attention to the stage directions and so on. You know, he's lifting up his right hand here and he's saying this there, and all of the stuff that is in these scripts that now today I usually scratch out. Well, I didn't get the part, and I gave, you know, what would, I guess, can be considered a very stiff reading. Then I went and visited the set and watched the actor, who happened to be this young actor who was in Saturday Night Fever, Barry Miller. I watched him do it. He was a very experienced young actor already at that time. In fact, I think he'd shot, but it hadn't come out, Saturday Night Fever. I'd been done a lot of theater, and New York actor. And I didn't hear any of the words that were in the script. I didn't see any of the stage directions being followed. I saw everything narratively being accomplished, but done with a freedom that I didn't know was okay. Like, I didn't see that green light. You know, I only knew, saw red and yellow on the thing, and didn't understand that an actor had a position to express. And that's what really lit me up. And I think the same is true about how I would have been. You know, I couldn't draw you to or guide you to the writers whose freedom most specifically would have been an influence, but the influence was the freedom itself, you know. And so, you know, well, Foster Wallace for sure. I think where I really felt structurally I'd do whatever the hell I wanted, you know, just to see that I wasn't crazy in the sense of my approach of the thing, to be able to read stuff that I responded to that disregarded any of the conventions. It wasn't an attempt to disregard conventions so much as it was to find something that allowed that melody that would be mine to come out.
I was so interested to hear you talk about the poetry in this novel, the poetry that you've written in the past leading up to this, because this is poetry infused as well as music infused. You know, there are little bits of doggerel, there are rhyming words that amuse you as you're tripping along the page. And the epilogue is practically a long ballad. So how much fun was it for you to go back to those poetic roots and weave them into fiction?
Well, I think there's the part of it where there are dreams or kind of those epiphanies that are had through a kind of magic realism in the character, within the character, within the psychology, within the way that he's provoked into passions that are not directly related to his current state of his personality or the limitations of it socially and so on. Like a child goes into dreaming of being a knight in some way, you know, through marble images and so on. And so when it would get into those things, or it would be in the dream state, or otherwise outside the burden of experiencing other individuals directly, it tended to go into that. It was just a melody I was following. And then, of course, one goes back editorially and says, well, let me look for cohesion in this, at least enough that I'm aware of, that is available to a reader, should my mind not be one that is so separate from the rest of humanity, which we all hope is the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can practically sing the epilogue if you think about it, you know? The language is so intense and poetic. You love alliteration, for example. It's a lot of fun when you're reading it to sit there and go back and read little bits aloud. And so I wondered if you'd read a little bit for us about Bob Honey's road trip.
Sure. The America Bob drives from Woodview to New Orleans is not that one of lore, not the one he'd known in his earliest cross-continental automotive excursions, not the one of pay-later gas stations, vintage diners, and two-lane roads. Only the trains remain in tribute to that spirit refuge now vanquished by modernity's craven trumpery. Vanquished as if by lightning blinding burdensome myths and dispersing misbehaviors exposed. Perhaps a truth worth grabbing and holding on to for dear life. That where life is really lived in the simple places of love and happiness. Bob owned neither. And in lieu of that, only solitude would suffice. There are few remaining romantic vistas experienced in the seclusion of reclusive roadways. In their place, interstates, strip malls, retail emporiums, traffic, roadwork, and bottlenecks. America, it seems to Bob, is no longer that beautiful girl who'd birthed him, but instead the ghost of a girl he'd never known.
Ah, thank you. Now, since we are in New Orleans, I have to ask you, Bob Honey surfaces in New Orleans as well in the course of this book. What has the city meant to you? I know you said that during this visit, New Orleans is the house and the set. What has the city meant to you over time? You've spent a good bit of time here. You were one of the first responders after Katrina. You've been instrumental in bringing two really important Louisiana books to the screen, All the King's Men and Dead Man Walking. So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
I wouldn't be in a unique category of person who considered New Orleans the only city of its kind in America. And in the best sense, almost not an American city.
Right.
Or if it is, it's a leading edge of it. There's a freedom of spirit here. There's a beauty to it. The history is clear. And the beauty to it really comes in the spirit and the talents of the people here. You feel creativity in the air. You know, you certainly feel racial diversity every day. We spend so much time in the Great North talking about the value of diversity, and yet we spend so little time interacting with each other. And so, and in New Orleans, it's such a mix. It's a race and gender, and everybody kind of plays together or knows each other, and there is generally a warmth. Of course, we know that it's a city that's also got tremendous problems, but uniquely post-Katrina, with all that was lost, and with all the failing of the federal government, and with some good leadership, and with a great population who, you know, demanded that they keep their melody.
Yes.
I watched the city lose its heart and then regain its heart.
It's a remarkable thing to see. It really is.
You know, when I think about this book and its satirical cynicism, that's, you know, there's truth in all humor. And that cynicism
is
also there. But New Orleans, in a way, is a kind of beacon of hope, if looked at that way. And it's certainly a place that, you know, you can't help but smile when you land. You can't help but smile when your car's coming from the airport and you're driving by a little bar and the music's coming out of it, you know, maybe on a very dark street with great architecture around it. The trees as you come through the Garden District, or the smell of beer piss on Bourbon Street.
Right.
Whatever, you know, all of it is just rich. And so I've just been turned on to the city since I first came here.
And for a long time.
Still am, yeah.
We've been talking with Sean Penn about his first novel, Bob Honey, Who Just Do Stuff. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Books about writers and literary places. I'm always making literary bucket lists, so I wanted to share two of my recent favorites with you. First up is Rooms of One's Own, 50 Places That Made Literary History by Adrian Mowerby. It's a global treat with great literary sites all over the world, from Italy to East Asia, St. Petersburg to North Africa. Local readers will be charmed by his visit to New Orleans, which recognizes Tennessee Williams' Toulouse Street address. As Mowerby said, I felt I could have stayed here, moved a few boxes, and done some writing myself. New Orleans appeals to the writer in us all. Amen to that. He also makes a visit to the Hotel Monteleone, honoring Truman Capote's time there, but he isn't at all sure about the decor of the suite honoring that author, finding the curtains overly ruched. And curiously, he doesn't make his way over to Faulkner House on Pirate Alley, a real omission here since he doesn't travel to Oxford, Mississippi. But despite those quibbles, this is a pleasure to read, imagining visits to Lafcadio Hearn's writing room in his house in Matsui, Japan, or a trip to Tangier in search of William S. Burroughs. The book ends, fittingly, with a visit to Monk's house in Rodmill, East Sussex, where Virginia Woolf had her room, one of the best. As a literary tourist, I often find myself bookstore-bound, lost for hours in Shakespeare and Company or Waterstones. Once at La Hune in Paris, now unfortunately closed, I saw Karl Lagerfeld getting into a limo with bags of books. Jorge Carrion's Bookshops, A Reader's History, is a brilliant and charming chronicle of bookstores around the world. His destinations are dreamy indeed. You know those photos of the world's most beautiful bookshops you see online? Carrion takes you inside them, introduces you to booksellers, and yes, buys a few books to schlep home. He spent more than 20 years in this endeavor, visiting five continents, taking us to the world's oldest, most elegant, and most famous bookshops. His expertise shows in his delightful discussions of topics such as the architecture of pleasure and the shadow of the Library of Alexandria, and sentences like, "One can walk around and read Athens as if it were a strange souk of bookshops." My husband courted me by visiting the bookshop where I worked every day, and we spent a whole day of our honeymoon at City Lights in San Francisco, so I can attest to Carrion's assertion that, as an erotic space, every bookshop is a supreme meeting place for booksellers and books, for readers and booksellers, or readers on the hoof. It is scarcely surprising that falling in love in a bookshop is a well-established literary and cinematic theme. Maybe think about that the next time you're tempted to swipe right and head to the bookstore instead. A literary bucket list can be a romantic endeavor indeed. Sometimes musicians just honor writers with their gifts and instrumental offerings. The Smiths pay tribute to the brilliant writer Oscar Wilde with this song, Oscillating Wildly, from their 1987 album, The World Won't Listen. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Sunday, March 25th is the final day of the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, as well as the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival, both headquartered at the Hotel Monteleone and taking place at various locations throughout the French Quarter. If you hurry, you can make the Stella and Stanley Shouting Contest in Jackson Square this afternoon. The Pirate Sally Faulkner Society presents its first Meet the Authors event of the spring season, Sunday, March 25th, from 1:30 to 4:30 at the Presbyter off Jackson Square. Featured authors are Mayor Mitch Landrieu, whose new book is In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History, Dr. Martha Boone, author of The Big Free, Jeffrey Round, author of Bon Temps Roulé, and Tom Sancton, author of The Betancourt Affair, The World's Richest Woman and the Scandal That Rocked Paris. Free, but reserve a seat at faulkhouse@aol.com, and your pass will be emailed to you in advance. Chandler O'Leary and Jessica Spring discuss and sign their beautiful letterpress-inspired book, Dead Feminist, Historic Heroines in Living Color, Monday, March 26th at 6 at Octavia Books, 513 Octavia Street in New Orleans. Judith Bonner, Senior Curator and Curator of Art at the Historic New Orleans Collection, discusses the history of women artists in New Orleans, Wednesday, March 28th at 6:30 at the Hubble Branch Library in Algiers. Dr. Mary Frances Berry discusses and signs History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times, Wednesday, March 28th at 6:30 at Octavia Books in New Orleans. Moscow Nights, a local theater troupe dedicated to the work of Russian authors and playwrights, will present a staged reading of 24 Hours in the Life of Pontius Pilate by Mikhail Bulgakov. That's Wednesday, March 28th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Novelist Taylor Brown signs Gods of Howl Mountain, Thursday, March 29th at 6 at Octavia Books. And coming up soon, the Big Book Sale, sponsored by the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library. It takes place April 5th through 8th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are Thursday through Saturday, April 5th through 7th, from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Sunday, April 8th, from noon to 5. Free admission, free parking. The sale includes more than 65,000 items. Auction items include George O'Keefe's 100 Flowers, a copy of The History of the Vietnam War, and the book Quadrupeds of North America by James Audubon. And start planning now to attend the Delta Mouth Literary Festival at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. That's April 6th through 8th and features Ann Gisselson, Dylan Krieger, Kiese Lehman, and many more. Check out the Facebook page or deltamouth.com for complete schedule. And here at The Reading Life, we're celebrating the New Orleans Tricentennial by putting together a list of 300 great books about New Orleans. Send us your favorites at labooks@wwno.org and see if they make the list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.